This is WMUK's Let's Hear It, Music of the Moment in West Michigan. I'm Kara Laurent. Thanks for coming along tonight.
I'm very pleased to welcome again conductor Andrew Kohler to WMUK. Andrew, you'll be leading a hugely significant piece, one single work, on Sunday's concert at Chenery Auditorium. The Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra will present Mahler's Resurrection Symphony.
It is perhaps, you know, I like to think of myself as someone who's not a stranger to ambitious undertakings, musically speaking. But we might have outdone ourselves this time. This is a really, really big effort for us, and it just takes so many people to put this piece on. But because of that, because of Mahler's incredible demands on the orchestra, on the chorus that has to join us, on soloists, it makes it all the more thrilling to try and undertake a project like this.
For a young person who maybe doesn't have a lot of spare time to listen to entire symphonies, you know, at one go, working, this almost might be inconceivable at first for a player.
I think so, you know, and I think I'm seeing in the orchestra a lot of people having this slow process of revelation that maybe isn't even fully complete yet, you know, might even take time after the concert. I firmly believe the reason I want to do something this sort of audacious and crazy is because I think that the students who participate in it will come away feeling just amazed by what they accomplished, as well they should, and amazed to have taken part in a piece of this depth. You know, I mean, this is really something that can resonate with a person for a lifetime, you know, just this one performance of it. You know, it's just really interesting to see people sort of first come to terms with the symphony in very, well, in a very prosaic way, I guess I'll say, right? I mean, they're just thinking, oh, well, that part's awfully difficult and those notes are tough and I've got to work through that. And then slowly get through that process until they're able to hear the work on a broader scale. And then hopefully to experience what it's really like to perform it, which will be coming up for us very shortly. And then to come away from that thinking, my God, that was really an amazing work. And for the first time, maybe I actually heard it. I was able to hear it, right? Because I had gotten comfortable enough with my part that I could step outside of it in a way and experience it as a total entity.
Ticket details and more are online at the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra website, kjso.org. Tickets also available at the door on Sunday. The concert again, 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium. This is not the first time you've programmed a Mahler symphony.
For the Junior Symphony, it certainly is, yes. But with my other orchestra, I have done the First Symphony of Mahler. And actually, with the Philharmonia, I also did the first movement of this symphony as a standalone effort. And that was years ago now, maybe, I don't know, 7 years ago or something like that. And the reason I did that was because the first movement of the symphony was itself initially intended to be a standalone tone poem. And it was only later that he turned it into this.
So you've had Mahler on the mind for a while.
I think it's a genetic condition for conductors. We can't avoid it, you know? Mahler was himself a conductor and therefore knew the orchestra inside and out. I mean, it's incredible to pore through his scores because unlike any other composer I can think of, it's full of all these little messages in a bottle to the conductor. I mean, he anticipates the bad habits of orchestras and writes in not to do them into the score, you know? There's a lot of marching rhythms in this piece, for example, you know, which involves what we would call as musicians a dotted rhythm, that is to say one longer note and one short, at a very precise proportion of 3-1, you know? So it's a sort of four-part rhythm like di, ta-ta, ta-ta, ta-ta. And that's difficult to play for any musician. So we tend to get a little sloppy with it and make the little note a little extra long so it starts sounding like da, 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 which we would call a triplet. And he says very clearly all over the score at those moments, not a triplet. Don't play a triplet, because he anticipates these sloppy habits that all musicians are prone to.
Even with the very fine orchestras that he was working with?
That's right, yeah. And I think probably, you know, we imagine, oh my goodness, I mean, he was the music director, as you're referencing, of the what's now called the Vienna State Opera, would have then been the Vienna Court Opera. And that must be, it is today one of the great orchestras of the world, that's from those ranks, that's where the Vienna Philharmonic comes. And that's certainly true, but I think we forget that, you know, the level of playing that we have today, especially because we have tended more and more to just repeat repertoire and kind of just really polish it and perfect it, is at what surely is, in terms of technical perfection, all-time high. And I'm not sure, you know, Mahler was famous for actually being quite irascible, you know? I mean, he was really a tough character on the podium, and that he would keep the orchestra extra long and really rehearse them. Everyone agreed that he made the orchestra sound a lot better, but at the cost of a lot of hours of effort. Mm-hmm. So I think perhaps the Vienna Court Opera in that day, even though we think of the current incarnation of that group as being peerless professionals, was still at a point where they needed some coaching. They needed to probably work out some bad habits, and obviously could be made to sound better than they did before Mahler began conducting there.
And he certainly had his own concept of how it should sound, and maybe that was a little different from anything else out there.
So no doubt. I mean, he is a man of unsurpassed vision, and I think that's borne out in his compositional life. I mean, the Romantic era, and he came at the very end of that era, was always concerned with grandiosity, with ambition. You know, the orchestra kept getting bigger and bigger, the pieces kept getting longer and longer, and Mahler really represents the very final step in that process before things break off and veer into modernity and a very different kind of musical aesthetic and set of values. But it's incredible what he achieved, and I think the Second Symphony is such a beautiful snapshot of the kind of romantic ambition that fueled that age, and Mahler in particular. There's a beautiful story, and it's often told, but I think for good reason, where Gustav Mahler meets with Jan Sibelius, the Finnish composer who was of a younger generation, and they're walking together in the woods. They both love nature. They shared that together. And Sibelius was talking to Mahler about his increasing feelings about the symphony, that this was something that had to have the severest logic and purity of form, that all the component parts had to fit together. And, you know, Sibelius, especially as he went through the rest of his life, would increasingly keep cutting down his symphonies, make these dramatic reductions in size and scope. Most famously, in his Fifth Symphony, for example, he had four separate movements, and he took the first and second, lopped off the last half of the first and the first half of the second, and then just put them together in one movement. I mean, he just wanted this, like, pure stream of logic. That's really what he felt the symphony was all about. And Mahler, who was a generation older still, much more rooted in the romantic ethos, responded to him, no, the symphony must be like the world. It must be all-embracing. And I think to listen to this symphony, number two, The Resurrection, that's very much what he's going for. It is the world. It is an enormous piece with enormous forces required, and which tackles no less weighty a theme than the very meaning of life itself. I mean, that's really what the symphony is aiming to discuss.
I have to ask, because there's soloists and chorus here, is this a reference to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony in any way?
It is indubitably a reference to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And, you know, the interesting thing is that Mahler's First Symphony was already in the heroic paradigm, that is to say, this vision of an eventual triumph after great struggle, which is absolutely something that Beethoven gifted to the romantic world. Yeah, and that's very much the Fifth Symphony of Beethoven, we might say. That's the journey from darkness to light, and that's what's mirrored in the First Symphony. It's absolutely a heroic ending. And then Mahler begins his Second Symphony with a funeral march. And he was quoted as saying that this was the funeral march for the hero of the First Symphony. And at the same time, you can also see the fact that, as you rightly point out, he's involving voice at the end of the symphony. And in much the same way that Beethoven does in his Ninth Symphony, that is to say, three instrumental movements and then finally the voice appears, I think he's very conscious, as every romantic composer was, of the weight of Beethoven before him and of trying to make what was for him a contemporary dialogue with the incredible legacy of Beethoven's music.
I guess if we're going to go in order of the symphony, we'll save our discussion on poetry and the chorus and things till later in the hour. So why don't we delve into the beginning of the symphony, if you would introduce us to how this piece opens.
It's, as I mentioned, a funeral march, and it is a particularly grim piece of music, although it is still cast in a sonata form. And sonata form was the same thing that Beethoven himself would have used, and even Mozart before him. And sonata form, by its very nature, really requires two thematic areas that contrast each other, and that Mahler provides. So there is some relief from the inexorable sense of marching and darkness in this funeral march. It's a very dramatic opening gesture, tremolo strings, and this furious, snarling, menacing gesture from the cellos and basses. And I think it's also a great example of how Mahler's music is so metrically flexible. That's one of its great challenges, and one of the things that I think is unique to his language. What I mean by that is that your listeners will observe that the tempo is constantly changing, sometimes in as little as a bar. Those little snarls I was just referencing are meant to go much faster than the overall tempo. And then they have to slow down a little bit, and then the march begins. And then parts of the march will suddenly leap forward and be much faster in tempo, and then suddenly pull back and be much more sternly footed. And it's just this constant pull and push of tempo. So even within the march, it still feels very much like a march. We'll feel that flexibility. And then right afterwards, because Mahler introduces both ideas as a kind of introduction before he explores them more fully, we hear a second thematic material, which is just a rising scale. And it's so beautifully serene and placid, and it really just marks this incredible contrast.
That's the opening of the Symphony No. 2 of Gustav Mahler, the Resurrection Symphony. My guest is conductor Andrew Kohler. The performance is Sunday at 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium. You'll be leading the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra, and we will have to acknowledge the additional support coming in for the end of the symphony in the form of local choir students and many schools involved there. So, however, let's continue the story of this piece, this symphony, that is Mahler's second symphony of nine he would eventually write.
Right? That's right, yes.
I think there's part of a tenth.
Yes, he started on a tenth symphony, and there's a sort of epic song cycle that lies somewhere between the worlds of symphony and song called Das Lied von der Erde.
And he's young at this time, or is he already, like Brahms, where he waited until...
He didn't wait that long. So he's certainly a mature composer. None of his work, I mean, the only extant work of his real youth is a fragment of a piano quintet. So he's definitely a mature composer at this point, but and already has a job at the Vienna Court Opera.
Okay. And married to Alma, or...?
yes, he is.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Already... surrounded by thinkers, artists, poets, and maybe discussing like big movements in art.
Well, in fact, you know, it's interesting. He absolutely was. Of course, he was involved in those sorts of discussions, and he was a major figure in the cultural life of Vienna. His mentor of a sort was the a great conductor and composer as well, but like Mahler himself in his day, better known as a conductor, Hans von Bülow, who was a colleague of Wagner's. That's sort of a polite way to say it, that he was a colleague of Wagner's. He was actually the man whose wife Wagner stole from out from under him. But that's a story for another time. And he played this very first movement for Hans von Bülow, looking to get some feedback when it was still just this movement, when he hadn't written the others yet. And von Bülow was just totally nonplussed, really confused about what was going on. The harmonic scheme was intensely complicated. The development was so intense and introduced all these new ideas. And he said something like, if I know music, then this cannot be music. This makes Tristan, which was Wagner's most revolutionary opera, sound like a Haydn symphony. And it's amazing in a way that that Mahler, despite this setback, was still able to gather the courage, the wherewithal to keep on, to decide, okay, well, not only do I keep this one movement, not only do I believe in it, but I'm going to extend it into an even larger symphony.
Well, you know, in some way, it's, I mean, today, you could see that as a compliment.
That's right.
He's acknowledging that
the progressive nature of the music. Absolutely. Yes, I suppose you could, but I'm pretty sure that the intention, that wasn't his intention at the time. I think he was older in his life and feeling very much like, I don't understand what this music is doing anymore. Interestingly, Mahler himself, because he also had that experience a few decades later where he would have heard the works of a young Schoenberg writing even more progressive and experimental and what would have seemed to him difficult to understand music. But he was always much more generous. He made sure not to repeat the mistakes, if we may call them that, of Hans von Bülow, and said openly to Schoenberg, I don't understand your music, but tried as best he could to support it. Anyway, but the interesting wrinkle here is that by the time Mahler expanded this into a full symphony, as we've already alluded, there is a text in the last movement. And that text about resurrection was something that he heard said at Hans von Bülow's funeral. And that was the point of inspiration that allowed him to continue the rest of the work and finally come up with a completion for it.
Shall we continue with first movement?
Yeah, I thought maybe we could dive into a little bit of the development. And this is just, you know, this is symphonic procedure, very much, the same sort of thing that Beethoven would have done, and that we can still see a process at work in the hands of Mahler a century later. We'll hear a beginning that clearly mimics what we just heard at the very beginning, that those menacing snarls, but made even more menacing. We have more people playing it, and there's some really aggressive percussion playing. We start a new march, and then we go through a series of themes, and one of the ones that's really interesting to listen for is this kind of chorale-like tune in the winds and brass, because what that eventually ends up being is a very important idea in the final movement. So Mahler's really playing the long game here. We're getting just a hint of this new thematic material in the middle of the development, and he will take that and make it into something really profound about an hour later.
Wow, we are enjoying this traversal of the Symphony No. 2 of Gustav Mahler with conductor Andrew Kohler, who will be leading a full performance of the work Sunday at 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium. Tickets available at the KJSO.org website or at the door. I'm breathless. This is very exciting stuff.
It's incredibly thrilling. And I think that's a good example. You know, the thing is, Mahler uses an enormous orchestra at his disposal, of course. That having been said, he's really good at being discreet with the use of that orchestra. There are many passages with just a few, I mean, he's a brilliant orchestrator, of course, but there are many passages with just a few instruments, very chamber-like almost. But he also knows when to wait and sort of pull out all the stops and let everybody go at it. And we just heard one of those passages. I think your listeners would have also gotten the sense of how many, even within a march kind of context, how many different sorts of tempos. There's sudden lurches forward in tempo, which makes it very exciting, and all kinds of interesting effects. At one point, listeners would have heard an effect where he asks all the string players to play these very fierce-sounding triplets with a bouncing bow so that you can actually, it bounces so violently you can hear the stick hit the string a little bit. So there's this sort of percussive clattering in the middle of all of it. I mean, just incredible effects. And obviously, because he knew the orchestra inside and out, I can't think of any other orchestrator who so exactly knew how to get the effects he wanted out of the combined forces of the ensemble.
Why did he have such a large number of musicians and instruments at his disposal? Was this a time of flourishing orchestras?
It was. It absolutely was. I mean, it just was a trend throughout the 19th century that the orchestras kept getting larger and larger. And as composers increasingly, as there was a value, cultural value placed on this kind of awe and shocking effect that you could get out of the orchestra, I think there was more and more prevalence of having interesting instruments in the orchestra, expanding the woodwinds so that there were the auxiliary instruments, things like bass clarinet or E-flat clarinet, both of which Mahler uses, or the English horn, so that he has a more extended range in each one of those instrument families and just has that many more sonic possibilities of combining instruments together.
What is the actual number of musicians who will be performing on Sunday?
I have lost count, but it's at least 80, and I'm pretty sure it's well above that at this point, with some of the extra offstage musicians that we also have to have. I would estimate something like, I mean, our normal forces are somewhere in the low 70s, and I'm pretty sure we must be up to 85 by now.
Would you quickly wrap up again the whole point of this first movement being this standalone tone poem at first?
That's right.
Was created
really a funeral march that was meant to bury the hero of his first symphony. And although we do have this sort of ray of hope in that second thematic material that we heard briefly, the end of the movement makes very clear that this is indeed a funeral march, and it ends with a thud. And because it ends so conclusively, Mahler was really worried about the second movement, which is much more in a nostalgic vein. It feels like this relaxed country dance. It's a kind of a modified Ländler, you know, an Austrian country minuet. He actually specifies in the score that a pause of no fewer than 5 minutes must take place between the first movement and the second movement. The second movement is really, that's not something that most performers tend to do today, and I don't think that I will this Sunday either, but we'll certainly let the air clear and everyone will need to take a breath because, as you just heard, the first movement is an incredibly intense experience in its own right and lasts about 20 minutes. So after the air clears, we can now listen to just a little bit of the second movement, and you can see why Mahler felt this was truly a world apart. This is a memory of childhood. It's unblemished, it's pure, and it's truly something that comes to the spirit of nature, which was something that was very close to Mahler's heart.
Thank you.
We're in the middle of the second movement of Gustav Mahler's Resurrection Symphony, the Symphony Number 2. I still find it kind of mind-boggling that he went for a home run on this second symphony, but it was part of the times.
It was, and part of his particular ethos, as I was saying, right? It must be all-embracing. It must be like the world. And I think each time that he wrote a symphony, he whether it was instrumental or a mix of instrumental and vocal, which several of his symphonies are, I think he tried to get to the spirit of that kind of capacious embracing of everything he could think of.
As you mentioned earlier, we can draw a parallel to how Beethoven constructed his Ninth Symphony, where with three instrumental movements and then the final movement bringing in the voice.
Right.
And that Mahler uses the same pattern here.
Just about, yeah, although he has three instrumental movements and then he inserts one pure song movement as a kind of bridge to the finale, which is, again, epic in length. So he actually has five movements here. But nonetheless, the notion that there's instrumental, a portion that's just instrumental, and then finally the voice comes in and also begins with a solo voice and then ends with a group, a chorus of voices, is very much following the pattern of Beethoven.
I asked you about how many musicians would be roughly performing on Sunday and around the number of 80. Does that also include the choirs?
Or? Oh, goodness, no. That's just the orchestra. Oh. No. Sorry. I thought I understood your question to be just the orchestra. That's about 85 in the orchestra plus two soloists plus 120 in the choir.
Okay.
So as you can imagine, you know Chenery Stage very well, as I'm sure many of your listeners do. It's going to be a clown car. It really is. Thankfully, our operations manager, Carol Corey, has been planning this to the last inch for months now. So we're hopeful we're going to pull it off, but it is going to be tight.
Mm, my goodness. Again, that's at 4:00. Tickets are available at the door at Chenery Auditorium on Sunday at 4:00 or before that through the website kjso.org. And you can find more information there, as well as directions on to Chenery if you've never been there, or a look at the entire season, past season of the KJSO, which has been quite significant and full of memorable moments.
Yeah.
Recently, a concert with the Stolberg bronze medalist.
As we do every year. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So these young people are really, you're guaranteeing them to come away with these incredible memories.
I hope so. I really hope so. And I hope that's true for our audience, too. I really feel like when we pull this many people together and engage in a work of this sort of life-changing depth and an incredible affirmation that, this is the core of what music is all about. It's a communal gathering for us to celebrate some fundamental aspect of our humanity, and this work does it in such a spectacular way.
So a funeral march, a nostalgic country dance, what happens in the third movement?
So interestingly, at the same time that he was working on the symphony, Mahler also was writing some songs, and these were songs based on a collection of poetry that were sort of dressed up folk poems. And it was called Des Knaben Wunderhorn, the youth's magic horn, as it's usually rendered in English. Mahler loved this collection of folk poetry. And he took one particular song and sort of stripped the text out of it and turned it into an orchestral scherzo. And that's what is the basis of the third movement. So we are in an interesting position because though Mahler often resisted programs, that is to say, very specifically telling us, okay, this movement means this, it has this kind of meaning, he sometimes did it a little bit, but he often felt that they were inadequate. But here we do have a text, so we know at least the point of inspiration that he was working from in composing this music. And the text is about St. Anthony of Padua giving a sermon to the fish. So he finds his church empty, and he goes out to the river and begins giving his sermon. And it's a very sardonic poem because the fish all come up. They slap their tails eagerly against the water. They really love the sermon. They find it fascinating. But then the poem concludes, though they enjoyed it, they got nothing from it. And the amazing thing is that Mahler takes this and I think turns this into a very actually dark rumination on the potential meaninglessness of life. how you can hear something and still not be moved by it, not understand it, not fully understand it. And this is obviously something that he feared greatly and that will come to resolution in the finale. But at this point, there are both sort of fun moments of this movement where, for example, we'll hear when we listen to the beginning, a very unusual percussion instrument called a rute, which is just basically twigs. That's how he envisioned it. And it's just being a bundle of sticks being slapped against the bass drum shell, which I'm certain is meant to be a sonic depiction of those fishtails against the water. And there's a sort of slithery quality to it, very slick and sinuous kind of writing. But at a later point in the movement that perhaps we'll have a chance to visit, there's this incredible moment where it seems like everything breaks open and we're standing at the edge of an abyss, a true terror, which we pull back from. And that moment is one that will be repeated in the finale again. So once again, we see Mahler plotting the long game in this incredible hour and a half symphony. There's so many subtle connections throughout the movements, which really do make it one cohesive statement.
Shall we begin at the beginning of the third movement?
Yes.
We're excerpting parts of an immense symphony by Gustav Mahler. My guest is Andrew Kohler. The performance is Sunday at 4 o'clock, and it's a significant moment in the lives of the musicians of the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra. There are other musicians we'll be acknowledging here in a moment when the choir and chorus comes into the piece. Again, 4 o'clock Sunday in Chenery Auditorium. One thing I thought of is we're listening to these beautiful melodies from Mahler, you said he tries to fit the entire world into a symphony, which to me sounds like everybody has to play at once. But that's not the case. There are such
delicate chamber textures, Absolutely transparency, really a master orchestrator.
It's over time feeling.
That's right. And he saves certain moments where he has everybody play together, obviously. And when those moments happen, they have such impact because of that. I mean, were he to just use the orchestra the entire time, that would become deadening. And that's really the power, I think, of his music, that he can, sort of really just restrain, hold back, delay, and then finally deliver. And that, in a spiritual sense, is what happens in this music as well. As you know, we've been traversing the symphony. We've gone from a funeral march to a nostalgic recollection to what is maybe a little kind of grappling with the possible pointlessness of life that we're hearing right now. In the fourth movement, which unfortunately I don't think we'll have time to really listen for, but is really just the most incredibly shatteringly beautiful music, we for the first time hear the human voice, and that's an alto solo. And she sings about the desire to return to heaven, to go to heaven. And she even sings for a second about the fact that perhaps there is an angel who will try and block my path. This is another Wunderhorn song, just like the third movement was, but this time the actual song with singing. And she says, but no, I must go back to God. I must go back to whence I came. So with this increasing intensity. But overall, the movement is just a beautiful little jewel, and it's by far the shortest movement. So it really just serves as a kind of vocal bridge between the worlds of the instrumental and then the final, ultimately, choral finale.
Who will be your alto soloist?
So thank you for asking. The alto soloist is Lauren Auge, who is coming to us from Chicago, wonderful mezzo-soprano herself, and we're really excited to get to work with her. She is joined then in the finale by a soprano soloist who is Lisa Borick, who is the daughter of Cindy Hunter, one of our choir directors, and obviously wonderful professional singer in her own right based now in Texas, and who will be coming home to join her mother on in this incredible undertaking. And then the choirs who are assembled, the 120 in numbers, are the choirs of Vicksburg High School, of Portage Northern, of Portage Central, and of Kalamazoo Central. And those are led by Dustin Morris at Vicksburg, by Teresa Williams Johnson at Kalamazoo Central, by Cindy Hunter at Portage Central, and by Robert Jordan at Portage Northern. And, you know, they say it takes a village, and we got several villages, I'm pretty sure, at work here at this point. And it is really just so exciting to have these wonderful colleagues joining us in this performance.
Do you know if they are preparing this on top of the curriculum they would normally be trying to check off?
I'm certain they are, because I can't imagine that they can sing this by itself in a concert. I mean, maybe they could, but there's so much interplay between the orchestra and chorus that it would be difficult, I imagine, for them to do it on their own. So, yes, they've taken on this challenge in addition to all the amazing teaching they're already doing in their schools, and I'm just so incredibly grateful that they're such eager and generous collaborators.
It's a one-time performance at 4 o'clock on Sunday, and it should be very, very special. Mahler's Resurrection Symphony. We are losing time here. It's almost 8 minutes before the top of the hour. So, well, let's move on to another highlight.
Well, I think I mentioned briefly in the third movement that there is a point at which the despair really gets quite grim and that we're standing on a precipice. And I think if we listen for just a second to the beginning of the fifth movement, that is the same music that we hear briefly in the third movement. The fifth movement opens after this incredible jewel of a fourth movement with this moment of terror and despair. But we'll be pulled back from that brink soon enough. Let's listen for just a second to this terrifying opening of the finale. That's an incredibly dramatic opening, and it's the same one that we heard in the third movement, as I was just mentioning. Now, from that sort of terrible opening, right, that terrifying opening, which again very much is an allusion to Beethoven's Ninth, which also begins with a, as Wagner called it, a Schreckensfanfare, right, the horrible fanfare. We sort of are pulled back from the brink. And then we hear a number of interesting ideas that that Mahler shows us. One of them is a version of that chorale we heard in the very first movement that I mentioned now minutes ago. And that part of the chorale we heard earlier sort of goes downward. But then he extends the chorale and there's an upward moving version of it. And that ultimately, that upward portion forms the basis of what the chorus will eventually sing when they enter. There's also all these offstage calls from the distance, from the beyond, that seem to encourage this notion that there will be a life after our deaths. And that's the solace that Mahler finally finds in his musings on the potential pointlessness of life and the sorrow of death. He says, but we will be risen again. So I think we can listen to this one interesting portion after he's had this, again, cataclysmic march and everything sort of collapses. We hear some of these offstage calls, and then finally the chorus begins to sing.
I just wanted to ask one more question. I know Beethoven was really inspired by this Schiller poem, Ode to Joy. Who is the poet of this text?
The poet of this text is Friedrich Klopstock, and that's the one who wrote the text that he heard at von Bülow's funeral that inspired this last movement. Although Mahler supplies much of the remainder of the text. It's just a sort of short beginning of the text, and then Mahler fills it out with a poetry in a similar spirit.
It was simply this vision of an afterlife that...
That's exactly right, that, yeah. That's what could give meaning to our purpose here.
All right. Well, I think we have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Andrew, all the best of luck for Sunday. I don't think you really need it. I think this is going to be such a special performance. Again, listeners, it's Sunday at 4 o'clock, the Resurrection Symphony of Gustav Mahler, led by Andrew Kohler, the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra, with 120 additional singers from area high school choirs. Just have at it.
It'll be an event. Okay. Thank you so much, Carol.